I. Benjamin Franklin. Born 1706, died 1790. His fame still climbing to heaven what he had done at 52 Poor Richard's address. The late Judge Black was remarkable not only for his wit and humor, which often enlivened the dry logic of law and fact, but also for flashes of unique eloquence. In presenting a certain brief before the United States Supreme Court, he had occasion to animadvert upon some of our great men. Among other things he said, as related to the writer by one who heard him, "The colossal name of Washington is growing year by year, underscore, and the fame of Franklin is still climbing to heaven, underscore," accompanying the latter words by such a movement of his right hand that not one of his hearers failed to see the immortal kite quietly bearing the philosopher's question to the clouds. It was a point which delivered the answer. In the life of every great man there is likewise a point which delivers the special message which he was born to publish to the world. Biography is greatly simplified when it confines itself chiefly to that one point. What does the reader, who has his own work to do, care for a great multitude of details which are not needed for the setting of the picture? Underscore to the point underscore is the cry of our busy life. Benjamin Franklin is here introduced to the reader. At 52. What had he done at that age to command more than ordinary respect and admiration? Born in poverty and obscurity, in which he passed his early years, with no advantages of education in the schools of his day, after he entered his teens, under the condition of daily toil for his bread, he had carried on, in spite of all obstacles, the process of self-education through books and observation, and become in literature and science, as well as in the practical affairs of everyday life, the best informed man in America. Apprenticed to a printer in his native Boston, at 13, a journeyman in Philadelphia at 17, working at the case in London at 19, back to the Quaker City, and set up for himself at 26, he had long since mastered all the details of a great business, prepared to put his hand to anything, from the trundling of paper through the streets on a wheelbarrow to the writing of editorials and pamphlets, and had earned for himself a position as the most prosperous printer and publisher in the colonies. Retired from active business at 46, considering that he had already earned and saved enough to supply his reasonable wants for the rest of his life, fired with ambition to do something for the advancement of science, he had now for 6 years given himself to philosophical investigation and experiment, among other things demonstrated the identity of electricity as produced by artificial means and atmospheric lightning, and made himself a name throughout the civilized world. Besides, it must not be forgotten that he had all along been foremost in many a work for the public good. The Franklin Library, of Philadelphia, owes to him its origin. The University of Pennsylvania grew out of an educational project in which he was a prime mover. And his ideas as to the relative importance of ancient and modern underscore classics underscore were more than 100 years in advance of his times. Such is a glimpse of Franklin at 52, as preliminary to a single episode which will occupy the rest of this chapter. But the episode itself requires a special word. For a quarter of a century Franklin had published an almanac under the underscore pseudonym underscore of Richard Saunders, into the pages of which he crowded year by year choice scraps of wit and wisdom, which made the little handbook a welcome visitor in almost every home of the New World. Now in the midst of those philosophical studies which so much delighted him, when about to cross the Atlantic as a commissioner to the home government, he found time to gather up the maxims and quaint sayings of 25 years and set them in a wonderful mosaic, as the preface of Poor Richard's world-famous almanac, as unique a piece of writing as any language affords. Here it is. Poor Richard's address. Courteous reader, I have heard that nothing gives an author so great pleasure as to find his works respectfully quoted by others. Judge, then, how much I must have been gratified by an incident I am going to relate to you. I stopped my horse lately where a great company of people were collected at an auction of merchants' goods. The hour of the sale not being come, they were conversing on the badness of the times, and one of the company called to a plain, clean old man, with white locks, "Pray, Father Abraham, what think you of the times? Will not those heavy taxes quite ruin the country? How shall we ever be able to pay them? What would you advise us to do?" Father Abraham stood up and replied, "If you would have my advice, I will give it you in short, for a word to the wise is enough, as poor Richard says." They joined in desiring him to speak his mind, and gathering around him, he proceeded as follows, "Friends," says he, "the taxes are indeed very heavy, and if those laid on by the government were the only ones we had to pay, we might more easily discharge them, but we have many others, and much more grievous to some of us. We are taxed twice as much by our idleness, 3 times as much by our pride, and 4 times as much by our folly, and from these taxes the commissioners cannot ease or deliver us by allowing an abatement. However, let us hearken to good advice, and something may be done for us, God helps them that help themselves, as Poor Richard says. It would be thought a hard government that should tax its people one-tenth of their time to be employed in its service, but idleness taxes many of us much more. Sloth, by bringing on disease, absolutely shortens life. Sloth, like rust, consumes faster than labor wears, while the used key is always bright, as Poor Richard says. But dost thou love life, then do not squander time, for that is the stuff life is made of, as Poor Richard says. How much more than is necessary do we spend in sleep? Forgetting that the sleeping fox catches no poultry, and that there will be sleeping enough in the grave, as Poor Richard says. If time be of all things the most precious, wasting time must be, as Poor Richard says, the greatest prodigality, since as he elsewhere tell us, lost time is never found again, and what we call time enough always proves little enough. Let us then up and be doing, and doing to the purpose, so by diligence shall we do more with less perplexity. Sloth makes all things difficult, but industry all easy, and he that riseth late must trottle day, and shall scarce overtake his business at night, while laziness travels so slowly, that poverty soon overtakes him. Drive thy business, let not that drive thee, and early to bed, and early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy and wise, as Poor Richard says. So what signifies wishing and hoping for better times? We may make these times better if we bestir ourselves. Industry need not wish, and he that lives upon hope will die fasting. There are no gains without pains, then help hands, for I have no lands, or if I have they are smartly taxed. He that hath a trade, hath an estate, and he that hath a calling, hath an office of profit and honor, as Poor Richard says, but then the trade must be worked at, and the calling well followed, or neither the estate nor the office will enable us to pay our taxes. If we are industrious we shall never starve, for at the working man's house hunger looks in, but dares not enter. Nor will the bailiff or the constable enter, for industry pays debts, while despair increaseth them. What though you have found no treasure, nor has any rich relation left a legacy, diligence is the mother of good luck, and God gives all things to industry. Then plow deep, while sluggards sleep, and you shall have corn to sell and to keep. Work while it is called today, for you know not how much you may be hindered tomorrow. One today is worth two tomorrows, as Poor Richard says, and farther, never leave the till tomorrow which you can do today. If you were a servant, would you not be ashamed that a good master should catch you idle? Are you then your own master? Be ashamed to catch yourself idle, when there is so much to be done for yourself, your family, your country, and your king. Handle your tools without mittens, remember, that the cat in gloves catches no mice, as Poor Richard says. It is true there is much to be done, and, perhaps, you are weak-handed, but stick to it steadily, and you will see great effects, for, constant dropping wears away stones, and by diligence, and patience the mouse ate into the cable, and little strokes fell great oaks. Methinks I hear some of you say, must a man afford himself no leisure? I will tell thee, my friend, what Poor Richard says, employ thy time well, if thou meanest to gain leisure, and, since thou art not sure of a minute, throw not away an hour. Leisure is time for doing something useful, this leisure the diligent man will obtain, but the lazy man never, for a life of leisure and a life of laziness are two things. Many, without labor, would live by their wits only, but they break for want of stock, whereas industry gives comfort, and plenty, and respect. Fly pleasures, and they will follow you. The diligent spinner has a large shift, and now I have a sheep and a cow, everybody bids me good morrow. But with our industry we must likewise be steady, settled, and careful, and oversee our own affairs with our own eyes, and not trust too much to others, for, as Poor Richard says, I never saw an oft-removed tree, nor yet an oft-removed family, that throve so well as those that settled be. And again, three removes is as bad as a fire, and again, keep thy shop, and thy shop will keep thee, and again, if you would have your business done, go, if not, send, and again. He that by the plough would thrive, himself must either hold or drive. And again, the eye of the master will do more work than both his hands, and again, want of care does us more damage than want of knowledge, and again, not to oversee workmen is to leave them your purse open. Trusting too much to others' care is the ruin of many, for, in the affairs of this world, men are saved, not by faith, but by the want of it, but a man's own care is profitable, for, if you would have a faithful servant, and one that you like, serve yourself. A little neglect may breed great mischief, for want of a nail the shoe was lost, for want of a shoe the horse was lost, and for want of a horse the rider was lost, being overtaken and slain by the enemy, all for want of a little care about a horseshoe nail. So much for industry, my friends, and attention to one's own business, but to these we must add frugality, if we would make our industry more certainly successful. A man may, if he knows not how to save as he gets, keep his nose all his life to the grindstone, and die not worth a groat at last. A fat kitchen makes a lean will, and many estates are spent in the getting, since women for tea forsook spinning and knitting, and men for punch forsook hewing and splitting. If you would be wealthy, think of saving, as well as of getting. The Indies have not made Spain rich, because her outgoes are greater than her incomes. Away then with your expensive follies, and you will not then have so much cause to complain of hard times, heavy taxes, and chargeable families, for women and wine, game and deceit, make the wealth small, and the want great. And farther, what maintains one vice would bring up two children. You may think, perhaps, that a little tea, or a little punch now and then, diet a little more costly, clothes a little finer, and a little entertainment now and then, can be no great matter, but remember, many a little makes a mickle. Beware of little expenses. A small leak will sink a great ship, as poor Richard says, and again, who dainties love, shall beggars prove, and moreover, fools make feasts, and wise men eat them. Here you are all got together to the sale of fineries and knick-knacks. You call them goods, but, if you do not take care, they will prove evils to some of you. You expect they will be sold cheap, and perhaps they may, for less than they cost, but if you have no occasion for them, they must be dear to you. Remember what poor Richard says, buy what thou hast no need of, and ere long thou shalt sell thy necessaries. And again, at a great pennyworth pause a while, he means, that perhaps the cheapness is apparent only, and not real, or the bargain, by straitening thee in thy business, may do thee more harm than good. For in another place he says, many have been ruined by buying good pennyworths. Again, it is foolish to lay out money in a purchase of repentance, and yet this folly is practiced every day at auctions, for want of minding the almanac. Many a one, for the sake of finery on the back, have gone with a hungry belly, and half-starved their families, silks and satins, scarlet and velvets, put out the kitchen fire, as poor Richard says. These are not the necessaries of life, they can scarcely be called the conveniences, and yet, only because they look pretty, how many want to have them. By these and other extravagances, the greatest are reduced to poverty, and forced to borrow of those whom they formerly despised, but who, through industry and frugality, have maintained their standing, in which case it appears plainly, that a ploughman on his legs is higher than a gentleman on his knees, as poor Richard says. Perhaps they have had a small estate left them, which they knew not the getting of, they think it is day, and will never be night, that a little to be spent out of so much is not worth minding, but always taking out of the meal tub, and never putting in, soon comes to the bottom, as poor Richard says, and then, when the well is dry, they know the worth of water. But this they might have known before, if they had taken his advice. If you would know the value of money, go and try to borrow some, for he that goes a-borrowing, goes a-sorrowing, as poor Richard says, and, indeed, so does he that lends to such people, when he goes to get it in again. Poor Dick farther advises, and says, fond pride of dress is sure a very curse, ere fancy you consult, consult your purse. And again, pride is as loud a beggar as want, and a great deal more saucy. When you have bought one fine thing, you must buy 10 more, that your appearance may be all of a piece, but poor Dick says, it is easier to suppress the first desire, than to satisfy all that follow it. And it is as truly folly for the poor to ape the rich, as for the frog to swell in order to equal the ox. Vessels large may venture more, but little boats should keep near shore. It is, however, a folly soon punished, for, as poor Richard says, pride that dines on vanity, sups on contempt, pride breakfasted with plenty, dined with poverty, and supped with infamy. And after all, of what use is this pride of appearance, for which so much is risked, so much is suffered? It cannot promote health, nor ease pain, it makes no increase of merit in the person, it creates envy, it hastens misfortune. But what madness it must be to run in debt for these superfluities. We are offered by the terms of this sale 6 months' credit, and that, perhaps, has induced some of us to attend it, because we cannot spare the ready money, and hope, now to be fine without it. But, ah! Think what you do when you run in debt, you give to another power over your liberty. If you cannot pay at the time, you will be ashamed to see your creditor, you will be in fear when you speak to him, you will make poor, pitiful, sneaking excuses, and, by degrees, come to lose your veracity, and sink into base downright lying, for the second vice is lying, the first is running in debt, as poor Richard says, and again, to the same purpose, lying rides upon debt's back, whereas a free-born Englishman ought not to be ashamed nor afraid to see or speak to any man living. But poverty often deprives a man of all spirit and virtue. It is hard for an empty bag to stand upright. What would you think of that prince, or of that government, who should issue an edict forbidding you to dress like a gentleman or gentlewoman, on pain of imprisonment or servitude? Would you not say that you are free, have a right to dress as you please, and that such an edict would be a breach of your privileges, and such a government tyrannical? And yet you are about to put yourself under that tyranny when you run in debt for such dress. Your creditor has authority, at his pleasure, to deprive you of your liberty, by confining you in jail for life, or by selling you for a servant, if you should not be able to pay him. When you have got your bargain, you may, perhaps, think little of payment, but, as poor Richard says, creditors have better memories than debtors. Creditors are a superstitious sect, great observers of days and times. The day comes round before you are aware, and the demand is made before you are prepared to satisfy it, or, if you bear your debt in mind, the term, which at first seemed so long, will, as it lessens, appear extremely short. Time will seem to have added wings to his heels as well as his shoulders. Those have a short Lent, who owe money to be paid at Easter. At present, perhaps, you may think yourselves in thriving circumstances, and that you can bear a little extravagance without injury, but for age and want save while you may, no morning sun lasts a whole day. Gain may be temporary and uncertain, but ever, while you live, expense is constant and certain, and it is easier to build two chimneys than to keep one in fuel, as poor Richard says, so, rather go to bed supperless than rise in debt. Get what you can, and what you get hold, 'tis the stone that will turn all your lead into gold. And, when you have got the philosopher's stone, sure you will no longer complain of bad times, or the difficulty of paying taxes. This doctrine, my friends, is reason and wisdom, but, after all, do riot depend too much upon your own industry and frugality and prudence, though excellent things, for they may all be blasted without the blessing of heaven, and, therefore, ask that blessing humbly, and be not uncharitable to those that at present seem to want it, but comfort and help them. Remember Job suffered, and was afterwards prosperous. And now to conclude, experience keeps a dear school, but fools will learn in no other, as poor Richard says, and scarce in that, for it is true, we may give advice, but we cannot give conduct. However, remember this, they that will not be counseled, cannot be helped, and farther, that, if you will not hear reason, she will surely rap your knuckles, as poor Richard says. Thus the old gentleman ended his harangue. The people heard it, and approved the doctrine, and immediately practiced the contrary, just as if it had been a common sermon, for the auction opened, and they began to buy extravagantly. I found the good man had thoroughly studied my almanac, and digested all I had dropped on these topics during the course of 25 years. The frequent mention he made of me must have tired anyone else, but my vanity was wonderfully delighted with it, though I was conscious that not a tenth part of the wisdom was my own which he ascribed to me, but rather the gleanings that I had made of the sense of all ages and nations. However, I resolved to be the better for the echo of it, and, though I had at first determined to buy stuff for a new coat, I went away, resolved to wear my old one a little longer. Reader, if thou wilt do the same, thy profit will be as great as mine. I am, as ever, thine to serve thee. Richard Saunders. This quaint address made a brilliant hit. It was at once printed on large sheets, framed, and hung up in cottages in England, as well as in this country. It was also translated into French, Spanish, and modern Greek. At the present day, however, it is not often met with, except in the author's collected works, or in fragments, and the young reader, especially, will be thankful to find it here in full, too. Defense of a great man. Was Dr. Franklin mean? James Parton's answer. A man of no enviable notoriety is reported to have spoken of Drive Franklin as hard, calculating, angular, unable to comprehend any higher object than the accumulation of money. Not a few people who profess much admiration for Franklin in other respects seem to think that in money matters there was something about him akin to meanness. To correct this false impression and show how Franklin got his money, how much he got, and what he did with it, one of his recent biographers is called up in his defense, and to the question, was Dr. Franklin mean? Here is James Parton's answer. I will begin with the first pecuniary transaction in which he is known to have been concerned, and this shall be given in his own words. When I was a child of 7 years old, my friends, on a holiday, filled my pockets with coppers. I went directly to a shop where they sold toys for children, and, being charmed with the sound of a whistle, that I met by the way in the hands of another boy, _ I voluntarily offered and gave all my money for one _. That was certainly not the act of a stingy, calculating boy. His next purchase, of which we have any knowledge, was made when he was about 11 years old, and this time, I confess, he made a much better bargain. The first book he could ever call his own was a copy of Pilgrim's Progress, which he read and reread until he got from it all so young a person could understand. But being exceedingly fond of reading, he exchanged his Pilgrim's Progress for a set of little books, then much sold by peddlers, called Burton's Historical Collections, in 40 paper-covered volumes, containing history, travels, tales, wonders, and curiosities, just the thing for a boy. As we do not know the market value of his Pilgrim's Progress, we cannot tell whether the poor peddler did well by him or the contrary. But it strikes me that that is not the kind of barter in which a mean, grasping boy usually engages. His father being a poor soap and candle maker, with a dozen children or more to support or assist, and Benjamin being a printer's apprentice, he was more and more puzzled to gratify his love of knowledge. But one day he hit upon an expedient that brought in a little cash. By reading a vegetarian book, this hard, calculating Yankee lad had been led to think that people could live better without meat than with it, and that killing innocent animals for food was cruel and wicked. So he abstained from meat altogether for about 2 years. As this led to some inconvenience at his boarding house, he made this cunning proposition to his master. "Give me one half the money you pay for my board and I will board myself." The master consenting, the apprentice lived entirely on such things as hominy, bread, rice, and potatoes, and found that he could actually live upon half of the half. What did the calculating wretch do with the money? Put it into his money box? No, he laid it out in the improvement of his mind. When at the age of 17, he landed in Philadelphia, a runaway apprentice, he had one silver dollar and 1 shilling in copper coin. It was a fine Sunday morning, as probably the reader remembers, and he knew not a soul in the place. He asked the boatman upon whose boat he had come down the Delaware how much he had to pay. They answered, nothing, because he had helped them row. Franklin, however, insisted upon their taking his shillings worth of coppers, and forced the money upon them. An hour after, having bought 3 rolls for his breakfast, he ate one and gave the other 2 to a poor woman and her child who had been his fellow passengers. These were small things, you may say, but remember he was a poor, ragged, dirty runaway in a strange town, 400 miles from a friend, with 3 pence gone out of the only dollar he had in the world. Next year when he went home to see his parents, with his pocket full of money, a new suit of clothes and a watch, one of his oldest Boston friends was so much pleased with Franklin's account of Philadelphia that he determined to go back with him. On the journey Franklin discovered that his friend had become a slave to drink. He was sorely plagued and disgraced by him, and at last the young drunkard had spent all his money and had no way of getting on except by Franklin's aid. This hard, calculating, mercenary youth, did he seize the chance of shaking off a most troublesome and injurious traveling companion? Strange to relate, he stuck to his old friend, shared his purse with him till it was empty, and then began on some money which he had been entrusted with for another, and so got him to Philadelphia, where he still assisted him. It was 7 years before Franklin was able to pay all the debt incurred by him to aid this old friend, for abandoning whom few would have blamed him. A year after he was in still worse difficulty from a similar cause. He went to London to buy types and a press with which to establish himself in business at Philadelphia, the governor of Pennsylvania having promised to furnish the money. One of the passengers on the ship was a young friend of Franklin's named James Ralph, with whom he had often studied, and of whom he was exceedingly fond. Ralph gave out that he, too, was going to London to make arrangements for going into business for himself at Philadelphia. The young friends arrived. Franklin 19 and Ralph a married man with 2 children. On reaching London Franklin learned, to his amazement and dismay, that the governor had deceived him, that no money was to be expected from him, and that he must go to work and earn his living at his trade. No sooner had he learned this than James Ralph gave him another piece of stunning intelligence, namely, that he had run away from his family and meant to settle in London as a poet and author. Franklin had £10 in his pocket, and knew a trade. Ralph had no money, and knew no trade. They were both strangers in a strange city. Now, in such circumstances, what would a mean, calculating young man have done? Reader, you know very well, without my telling you. What Franklin did was this: he shared his purse with his friend till his £10 were all gone, and having at once got to work at his trade, he kept on dividing his wages with Ralph until he had advanced him £36 half a year's income, not a penny of which was ever repaid. And this he did, the cold-blooded wretch. Because he could not help loving his brilliant, unprincipled comrade, though disapproving his conduct and sadly needing his money. Having returned to Philadelphia, he set up in business as a printer and editor, and, after a very severe effort, he got his business well established, and at last had the most profitable establishment of the kind in all America. During the most active part of his business life, he always found some time for the promotion of public objects. He founded a most useful and public-spirited club, a public library, which still exists, and assisted in every worthy scheme. He was most generous to his poor relations, hospitable to his fellow citizens, and particularly interested in his journeymen, many of whom he set up in business. The most decisive proof, however, which he ever gave that he did not overvalue money, was the retirement from a most profitable business for the purpose of having leisure to pursue his philosophical studies. He had been in business 20 years, and he was still in the prime of life 46 years of age. He was making money faster than any other printer on this continent. But being exceedingly desirous of spending the rest of his days in study and experiment, and having saved a moderate competency, he sold his establishment to his foreman on very easy terms, and withdrew. His estate, when he retired, was worth about $100,000. If he had been a lover of money, I am confident that he could and would have accumulated one of the largest fortunes in America. He had nothing to do but continue in business, and take care of his investments, to roll up a prodigious estate. But not having the slightest taste for needless accumulation, he joyfully laid aside the cares of business, and spent the whole remainder of his life in the services of his country, for he gave up his heart's desire of devoting his leisure to philosophy when his country needed him. Being in London when Captain Cook returned from his first voyage to the Pacific, he entered warmly into a beautiful scheme for sending a ship for the purpose of stocking the islands there with pigs, vegetables, and other useful animals and products. A hard, selfish man would have laughed such a project to scorn. In 1776, when he was appointed ambassador of the revolted colonies to the French king, the ocean swarmed with British cruisers, General Washington had lost New York, and the prospects of the revolution were gloomy in the extreme. Dr. Franklin was an old man of 70, and might justly have asked to be excused from a service so perilous and fatiguing. But he did not. He went. And just before he sailed, he got together all the money he could raise, about £3,000, and invested it in the loan recently announced by Congress. This he did at a moment when few men had a hearty faith in the success of the revolution. This he did when he was going to a foreign country that might not receive him, from which he might be expelled, and he have no country to return to. There never was a more gallant and generous act done by an old man. In France he was as much the mainstay of the cause of his country as General Washington was at home. Returning home after the war, he was elected President of Pennsylvania for 3 successive years, at a salary of £2,000 a year. But by this time he had become convinced that offices of honor, such as the governorship of a state, ought not to have any salary attached to them. He thought they should be filled by persons of independent income, willing to serve their fellow citizens from benevolence, or for the honor of it. So thinking, he at first determined not to receive any salary, but this being objected to, he devoted the whole of the salary for 3 years £6,000 to the furtherance of public objects. Part of it he gave to a college, and part was set aside for the improvement of the Schuylkill River. Never was an eminent man more thoughtful of people who were the companions of his poverty. Dr. Franklin, from amidst the splendors of the French court, and when he was the most famous and admired person in Europe, forgot not his poor old sister, Jane, who was in fact dependent on his bounty. He gave her a house in Boston, and sent her every September the money to lay in her winter's fuel and provisions. He wrote her the kindest, wittiest, pleasantest letters. "Believe me, dear brother," she writes, "your writing to me gives me so much pleasure that the great, the very great, presents you have sent me give me but a secondary joy." How exceedingly absurd to call such a man hard and miserly, because he recommended people not to waste their money. Let me tell you, reader, that if a man means to be liberal and generous, he must be economical. No people are so mean as the extravagant, because, spending all they have upon themselves, they have nothing left for others. Benjamin Franklin was the most consistently generous man of whom I have any knowledge. 3. Sir Walter Scott and his mother. The mother's education, the son's training, domestic love and social duties. It was in the spring of 1758 that the daughter of a distinguished professor of medicine in the University of Edinburgh changed her maiden name of Rutherford for her married name of Scott, having the happiness to unite her lot with one who was not only a scrupulously honorable man, but who, from his youth up, had led a singularly blameless life. Well does Coventry Patmore sing: "Who is the happy husband? He, who, scanning his unwedded life, thanks heaven, with a conscience free, 'twas faithful to his future wife." Such a husband as this was the father of Sir Walter Scott, a writer to the Signet, or lawyer, in large practice in Edinburgh. He had never been led from the right way, and when the less virtuously inclined among the companions of his early life in Edinburgh found that they could not corrupt him, they ceased after a little while to laugh at him, and learned to honour him and to confide in him, which is certainly, says he who makes the record on the authority of Mrs. Scott herself, a great inducement to young men in the outset of life to act a similar part. It does not appear that old Walter Scott sought for beauty of person in his bride, though no doubt the face he loved was more beautiful to him than that of the bonniest belle in Scotland, but beauty of mind and disposition she certainly had. Of her father it is told that, when in practice as a physician, he never gave a prescription without silently invoking on it the blessing of heaven, and the piety which dictated the custom had been inherited by his daughter. The mother's education. Mrs. Scott's education, also, had been an excellent one, giving, besides a good general grounding, an acquaintance with literature, and not neglecting the more homely duties of the needle and the account book. Her manners, moreover, an important and too often neglected factor in a mother's influence over her children, were finished and elegant, though intolerably stiff in some respects, when compared with the manners and habits of today. The maidens of today can scarcely realize, for instance, the asperity of the training of their embryo great-grandmothers, who were always made to sit in so spartanly upright a posture that Mrs. Scott, in her 79th year, boasted that she had never allowed her shoulders to touch the back of her chair. The son's training. As young Walter was one of many children, he could not, of course, monopolize his mother's attention, but probably she recognized the promise of his future greatness, unlike the mother of the Duke of Wellington, who thought Arthur the family duns, and gave him a special care, for, speaking of his early boyhood, he tells us, "I found much consolation in the partiality of my mother." And he goes on to say that she joined to a light and happy temper of mind a strong turn to study poetry and works of imagination. Like the mothers of the Ettrick Shepherd and of Burns, she repeated to her son the traditionary ballads she knew by heart, and, so soon as he was sufficiently advanced, his leisure hours were usually spent in reading Pope's translation of Homer aloud to her, which, with the exception of a few ballads and some of Alan Ramsay's songs, was the first poetry he made acquaintance with. It must often have been with anxiety, and sometimes not without a struggle, that his mother, solicitous about every trifle which affected the training of her child, decided on the books which she was to place in his hands. She wished him to develop his intellectual faculties, but not at the expense of his spiritual and romantic frivolity and mental dissipation on the one hand, and a too severe repression dangerous in its after-reaction on the other, were the Scylla and Charybdis between which she had to steer. The ascetic puritanism of her training and surroundings would naturally have led her to the narrower and more restrictive view, in which her husband, austerer yet, would have heartily concurred, but her broad sense, quickened by the marvelous insight that comes from maternal love, led her to adopt the broader, and, we may safely add, with Sir Walter's career and character before us, the better course. Her courage was, however, tempered with a wise discretion, and when he read to her she was wont, he says, to make him pause upon those passages which express generous and worthy sentiments, a most happy method of education, and a most effective one in the case of an impressionable boy. A little later, when he passed from the educational care of his mother to that of a tutor, his relations to literature changed, as the following passage from his autobiography will show: "My tutor thought it almost a sin to open a profane play or poem, and my mother had no longer the opportunity to hear me read poetry as formerly. I found, however, in her dressing room, where I slept at one time, some odd volumes of Shakespeare, nor can I easily forget the rapture with which I sat up in my shirt reading them by the light of a fire in her apartment, until the bustle of the family rising from supper warned me that it was time to creep back to my bed, where I was supposed to have been safely deposited since 9 o'clock. This is a suggestive, as well as frank, story. Supposing for a moment that instead of Shakespeare the room had contained some of the volumes of verse and romance which, though denying alike the natural and the supernatural virtues, are to be found in many a Christian home, how easily might he have suffered a contamination of mind." Domestic love and social duty. It has been proudly said of Sir Walter as an author that he never forgot the sanctities of domestic love and social duty in all that he wrote, and considering how much he did write, and how vast has been the influence of his work on mankind, we can scarcely overestimate the importance of the fact. Yet it might have been all wrecked by one little parental imprudence in this matter of books. And what excuse is there, after all, for running the terrible risk? Authors who are not fit to be read by the sons and daughters are rarely read without injury by the fathers and mothers, and it would be better by far, Savonarola alike, to make a bonfire of all the literature of folly, wickedness, and infidelity, than run the risk of injuring a child simply for the sake of having a few volumes more on one's shelves. In the balance of heaven there is no parity between a complete library and a lost soul. But this story has another lesson. It indicates once more the injury which may be done to character by undue limitations. Under the ill-considered restrictions of his tutor, which ran counter to the good sense of his mother, whose wisdom was justified by the event, Walter Scott might easily have fallen into tricks of concealment and forfeited his candor, the candor which developed into the noble probity which marked his conduct to the last. Without candor there cannot be truth, and, as he himself has said, there can be no other virtue without truth. Fortunately for him, by the wise sanction his mother had given to his perusal of imaginative writings, she had robbed them of a mystery unhealthy in itself, and he came through these stolen readings substantially unharmed, because he knew that his fault was only the lighter one of sitting up when he was supposed to be lying down. Luckily this tutor's stern rule did not last long, and when a severe illness attacked the youth, then advanced to be a student at Edinburgh College, and brought him under his mother's charge once more, the bed on which he lay was piled with a constant succession of works of imagination, and he was allowed to find consolation in poetry and romance, those fountains which flow forever for the ardent and the young. It was in relation to Mrs. Scott's control of her son's reading that he wrote with gratitude, "Late in life, my mother had good natural taste and great feeling." And after her death, in a letter to a friend, he paid her this tribute, "She had a mind peculiarly well stored. If I have been able to do anything in the way of painting the past times, it is very much from the studies with which she presented me. She was a strict economist, which, she said, enabled her to be liberal. Out of her little income of about $1,500 a year, she bestowed at least a third in charities, yet I could never prevail on her to accept of any assistance. Her charity, as well as her love for genealogy, and her aptitude for storytelling, was transmitted to her son. It found expression in him, not only in material gifts to the poor, but in a conscientious care and consideration for the feelings of others. This trait is beautifully exhibited by many of the facts recorded by Lockhart in his famous memoir, and also by a little incident, not included there, which I have heard Sir Henry Taylor tell, and which, besides illustrating the subject, deserves for its own sake a place in print. The great and now venerable author of Philip Van Artevelde dined at Abbotsford only a year or two before the close of its owner's life. Sir Walter had then lost his old vivacity, though not his simple dignity, but for one moment during the course of the evening he rose into animation, and it happened thus: there was a talk among the party of an excursion which was to be made on the following day, and during the discussion of the plans Miss Scott mentioned that two elderly maiden ladies, living in the neighborhood, were to be of the number, and hinted that their company would be a bore. The chivalrous kindliness of her father's heart was instantly aroused. "I cannot call that good breeding," he said, in an earnest and dignified tone, a rebuke which echoed the old-fashioned teaching on the duties of true politeness he had heard from his mother half a century before. "We would gladly know more than we do of Mrs. Scott's attitude toward her son when first his __ for authorship was shown. That she smiled on his early evidences of talent, and fostered them, we may well imagine, and the tenderness with which she regarded his early compositions is indicated by the fact that a copy of verses, written in a boyish scrawl, was carefully preserved by her, and found, after her death, folded in a paper on which was inscribed, 'My Walter's First Lines, 1782. That she gloried in his successes when they came, we gather, for when speaking late in life to Dr. Davy about his brother Sir Humphrey's distinction, Sir Walter, doubtless drawing on his own home memories, remarked, "I hope, Dr. Davy, that your mother lived to see it, there must have been great pleasure in that to her." But with whatever zeal Mrs. Scott may have unfolded Sir Walter's mind by her training, by her praise, by her motherly enthusiasm, it is certain that, from first to last, she loved his soul, and sought its interest, in and above all. Her final present to him before she died was not a Shakespeare or a Milton, but an old Bible, the book she loved best, and for her sake Sir Walter loved it too. Happy was Mrs. Scott in having a son who in all things reciprocated the affection of his mother. With the first 5 guinea fee he earned at the bar he bought a present for her, a silver taper stand, which stood on her mantelpiece many a year. When he became enamored of Miss Carpenter he filially wrote to consult his mother about the attachment, and to beg her blessing upon it. When, in 1819, she died at an advanced age, he was in attendance at her side, and, full of occupations though he was, we find him busying himself to obtain for her body a beautifully situated grave. 13 years later he also rested from his labors. During the last hours of his lingering life he desired to be read to from the New Testament, and when his memory for secular poetry had entirely failed him, the words and the import of the sacred volume were still in his recollection, as were also some of the hymns of his childhood, which his grandson, aged 6 years, repeated to him. "Lockhart," he said to his son-in-law, I have but a minute to speak to you. My dear, be a good man, be virtuous, be religious, be a good man. Nothing else will give you any comfort when you come to lie here." So passed the great author of Waverley away. And when, in due course, his executors came to search for his testament, and lifted up his desk, "We found," says one of them, "arranged in careful order a series of little objects, which had obviously been so placed there that his eye might rest on them every morning before he began his tasks. There were the old-fashioned boxes that had garnished his mother's toilet table when he, a sickly child, slept in her dressing room, the silver taper stand which the young advocate bought for her with his first fee, a row of small packets inscribed by her hand, and containing the hair of such of her children as had died before her, and more odds and ends of a like sort, pathetic tokens of a love which bound together for a little while here on earth, and binds together forevermore in heaven, Christian mother and son. Sir Walter of the land of song and old romance, tradition in his cunning hand obedient as the lance. His valiant black knight bore, wove into literature the legend, myth, and homely lore which now for us endure. To charm our weary hours, to rouse our stagnant hearts, and leave the sense of newborn powers, which never more departs. We thank him in the name of one who sits on high, and aye abides in every fame which makes a brighter sky. 4. Abigail Adams. Born 1744, died 1818. The wife of our second president, the mother of our sixth. Abigail Smith, the daughter of a congregational minister, of Weymouth, Massachusetts, was one of the most noted women of our early history. She left a record of her heart and character, and to some extent a picture of the stirring times in which she lived, in the shape of letters which are of perennial value, especially to the young. It was fashionable to ridicule female learning in her day, and she says of herself in one of her letters, "I was never sent to any school." She adds in explanation, "I was always sick." When girls, however, were sent to school, their education seldom went beyond writing and arithmetic. But in spite of disadvantages, she read and studied in private, and by means of correspondence with relatives and others, cultivated her mind, and formed an easy and graceful style of writing. On the 25th of October, 1764, Miss Smith became the wife of John Adams, a lawyer of Braintree, the part of the town in which he lived being afterwards called Quincy, in honor of Mrs. Adams's maternal grandfather. Charles Francis Adams, her grandson, from whose memoir of her the material for this brief sketch is drawn, says that the 10 years immediately following her marriage present little that is worth recording. But when the days of the Revolution came on, those times that tried men's souls, women were by no means exempt from tribulation, and they, too, began to make history. The strength of Mrs. Adams's affection for her husband may be learned from an extract from one of her letters. "I very well remember when Eastern circuits of the courts, which lasted a month, were thought an age, and an absence of 3 months intolerable, but we are carried from step to step, and from one degree to another, to endure that which we at first think impossible." In 1778 her husband went as one of the commissioners to France. During his absence Mrs. Adams managed, as she had often done before, both the household and the farm, a true wife and mother of the Revolution. She was a farmer cultivating the land, and discussing the weather and the crops, a merchant reporting prices current and the rates of exchange, and directing the making up of invoices, a politician speculating upon the probabilities of peace and war, and a mother writing the most exalted sentiments to her son. John Quincy Adams, the son, in his 12th year, was with his father in Europe. The following extracts are from letters to him, dated 1778-80. "'Tis almost 4 months since you left your native land, and embarked upon the mighty waters, in quest of a foreign country. Although I have not particularly written to you since, yet you may be assured you have constantly been upon my heart and mind. It is a very difficult task, my dear son, for a tender parent to bring her mind to part with a child of your years going to a distant land, nor could I have acquiesced in such a separation under any other care than that of the most excellent parent and guardian who accompanied you. You have arrived at years capable of improving under the advantages you will be likely to have, if you do but properly attend to them. They are talents put into your hands, of which an account will be required of you hereafter, and being possessed of one, two, or four, see to it that you double your numbers. The most amiable and most useful disposition in a young mind is diffidence of itself, and this should lead you to seek advice and instruction from him who is your natural guardian, and will always counsel and direct you in the best manner, both for your present and future happiness. You are in possession of a natural good understanding, and of spirits unbroken by adversity and untamed with care. Improve your understanding by acquiring useful knowledge and virtue, such as will render you an ornament to society, an honor to your country, and a blessing to your parents. Great learning and superior abilities, should you ever possess them, will be of little value in small estimation unless virtue, honor, truth, and integrity are added to them. Adhere to those religious sentiments and principles which were early instilled into your mind, and remember that you are accountable to your Maker for all your words and actions. Let me enjoin it upon you to attend constantly and steadfastly to the precepts and instructions of your father, as you value the happiness of your mother and your own welfare. His care and attention to you render many things unnecessary for me to write, which I might otherwise do, but the inadvertency and heedlessness of youth require line upon line and precept upon precept, and, when enforced by the joint efforts of both parents, will, I hope, have a due influence upon your conduct, for, dear as you are to me, I would much rather you should have found your grave in the ocean you have crossed, or that any untimely death crop you in your infant years, than see you an immoral, profligate, or graceless child. You have entered early in life upon the great theater of the world, which is full of temptations and vice of every kind. You are not wholly unacquainted with history, in which you have read of crimes which your inexperienced mind could scarcely believe credible. You have been taught to think of them with horror, and to view vice as a monster of so frightful mien, that, to be hated, needs but to be seen. Yet you must keep a strict guard upon yourself, or the odious monster will soon lose its terror by becoming familiar to you. The modern history of our own times furnishes as black a list of crimes as can be paralleled in ancient times, even if we go back to Nero, Caligula, or Caesar Borgia. Young as you are, the cruel war into which we have been compelled by the haughty tyrant of Britain and the bloody emissaries of his vengeance, may stamp upon your mind this certain truth, that the welfare and prosperity of all countries, communities, and, I may add, individuals, depend upon their morals. That nation to which we were once united, as it has departed from justice, eluded and subverted the wise laws which formerly governed it, and suffered the worst of crimes to go unpunished, has lost its valor, wisdom, and humanity, and, from being the dread and terror of Europe, has sunk into derision and infamy. Some author, that I have met with, compares a judicious traveler to a river, that increases its stream the further it flows from its source, or to certain springs, which, running through rich veins of minerals, improve their qualities as they pass along. It will be expected of you, my son, that, as you are favored with superior advantages under the instructive eye of a tender parent, your improvement should bear some proportion to your advantages. Nothing is wanting with you but attention, diligence, and steady application. Nature has not been deficient. These are times in which a genius would wish to live. It is not in the still calm of life, or the repose of a pacific station, that great characters are formed. Would Cicero have shown so distinguished an orator if he had not been roused, kindled, and inflamed by the tyranny of Catiline, Verres, and Mark Antony? The habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with difficulties. All history will convince you of this, and that wisdom and penetration are the fruit of experience, not the lessons of retirement and leisure. Great necessities call out great virtues. When a mind is raised and animated by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities, which would otherwise lie dormant, wake into life and form the character of the hero and statesman. War, tyranny, and desolation are the scourges of the Almighty, and ought no doubt to be deprecated. Yet it is your lot, my son, to be an eyewitness of these calamities in your own native land, and, at the same time, to owe your existence among a people who have made a glorious defense of their invaded liberties, and who, aided by a generous and powerful ally, with the blessing of heaven, will transmit this inheritance to ages yet unborn. Nor ought it to be one of the least of your incitements towards exerting every power and faculty of your mind, that you have a parent who has taken so large and active a share in this contest, and discharged the trust reposed in him with so much satisfaction as to be honored with the important embassy which at present calls him abroad. The strict and inviolable regard you have ever paid to truth gives me pleasing hopes that you will not swerve from her dictates, but add justice, fortitude, and every manly virtue which can adorn a good citizen, do honor to your country, and render your parents supremely happy, particularly your ever affectionate mother. The only sure and permanent foundation of virtue is religion. Let this important truth be engraven upon your heart. And also, that the foundation of religion is the belief of the one only God, and a just sense of his attributes, as a being infinitely wise, just, and good, to whom you owe the highest reverence, gratitude, and adoration, who superintends and governs all nature, even to clothing the lilies of the field, and hearing the young ravens when they cry, but more particularly regards man, whom he created after his own image, and breathed into him an immortal spirit, capable of a happiness beyond the grave, for the attainment of which he is bound to the performance of certain duties, which all tend to the happiness and welfare of society, and are comprised in one short sentence, expressive of universal benevolence: thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Justice, humanity, and benevolence are the duties you owe to society in general. To your country the same duties are incumbent upon you, with the additional obligation of sacrificing ease, pleasure, wealth, and life itself for its defense and security. To your parents you owe love, reverence, and obedience to all just and equitable commands. To yourself, here, indeed, is a wide field to expatiate upon. To become what you ought to be, and what a fond mother wishes to see you, attend to some precepts and instructions from the pen of one who can have no motive but your welfare and happiness, and who wishes in this way to supply to you the personal watchfulness and care which a separation from you deprived you of at a period of life when habits are easiest acquired and fixed, and though the advice may not be new, yet suffer it to obtain a place in your memory, for occasions may offer, and perhaps some concurring circumstances unite, to give it weight and force. Suffer me to recommend to you one of the most useful lessons of life: the knowledge and study of yourself. There you run the greatest hazard of being deceived. Self-love and partiality cast a mist before the eyes, and there is no knowledge so hard to be acquired, nor of more benefit when once thoroughly understood. Ungoverned passions have aptly been compared to the boisterous ocean, which is known to produce the most terrible effects. Passions are the elements of life, but elements which are subject to the control of reason. Whoever will candidly examine themselves, will find some degree of passion, peevishness, or obstinacy in their natural tempers. You will seldom find these disagreeable ingredients all united in one, but the uncontrolled indulgence of either is sufficient to render the possessor unhappy in himself, and disagreeable to all who are so unhappy as to be witnesses of it, or suffer from its effects. You, my dear son, are formed with a constitution feelingly alive, your passions are strong and impetuous, and, though I have sometimes seen them hurry you into excesses, yet with pleasure I have observed a frankness and generosity accompany your efforts to govern and subdue them. Few persons are so subject to passion but that they can command themselves when they have a motive sufficiently strong, and those who are most apt to transgress will restrain themselves through respect and reverence to superiors, and even, where they wish to recommend themselves, to their equals. The due government of the passions has been considered in all ages as a most valuable acquisition. Hence an inspired writer observes, "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit, than he that taketh a city." This passion, cooperating with power, and unrestrained by reason, has produced the subversion of cities, the desolation of countries, the massacre of nations, and filled the world with injustice and oppression. Behold your own country, your native land, suffering from the effects of lawless power and malignant passions, and learn betimes, from your own observation and experience, to govern and control yourself. Having once obtained this self-government, you will find a foundation laid for happiness to yourself and usefulness to mankind. Virtue alone is happiness below, and consists in cultivating and improving every good inclination, and in checking and subduing every propensity to evil. I have been particular upon the passion of anger, as it is generally the most predominant passion at your age, the soonest excited, and the least pains are taken to subdue it. What composes man, can man destroy? With such a mother to counsel him, one is led to ask, how could John Quincy Adams help becoming a noble-minded and great man? Who wonders that, with good natural endowments and his excellent privileges, coupled with maternal training, he fitted himself to fill the highest office and the gift of a free people? In June, 1784, Mrs. Adams sailed for London, to join her husband, who was then our minister at the court of St. James. While absent, she visited France and Netherlands, resided for a time in the former country, and returned with her knowledge of human nature, of men, manners, etc., enlarged, disgusted with the splendor and sophistications of royalty, and well prepared to appreciate the republican simplicity and frankness of which she was herself a model. While Mr. Adams was vice president and president, she never laid aside her singleness of heart and that sincerity and unaffected dignity which had won for her many friends before her elevation, and which, in spite of national animosity, conquered the prejudices and gained the heart of the aristocracy of Great Britain. But her crowning virtue was her Christian humility, which is beautifully exemplified in a letter which she wrote to Mr. Adams, on the 8th of February, 1797, the day on which the votes for president were counted, and Mr. Adams, as vice president, was required by law to announce himself the president-elect for the ensuing term. "The sun is dressed in brightest beams, to give high honors to the day. And may it prove an auspicious prelude to each ensuing season. You have this day to declare yourself head of a nation. And now, O Lord, my God, thou hast made thy servant ruler over the people. Give unto him an understanding heart, that he may know how to go out and come in before this great people, that he may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this thy so great a people? Were the words of a royal sovereign, and not less applicable to him who is invested with the chief magistracy of a nation, though he wear not a crown nor the robes of royalty. My thoughts and my meditations are with you, though personally absent, and my petitions to heaven are, that the things which make for peace may not be hidden from your eyes. My feelings are not those of pride or ostentation, upon the occasion. They are solemnized by a sense of the obligations, the important trusts, and numerous duties connected with it. That you may be enabled to discharge them with honor to yourself, with justice and impartiality to your country, and with satisfaction to this great people, shall be the daily prayer of your AA. From her husband's retirement from the presidency in 1801, to the close of her life in 1818, Mrs. Adams remained constantly at Quincy. Cheerful, contented, and happy, she devoted her last years, in that rural seclusion, to the reciprocities of friendship and love, to offices of kindness and charity, and, in short, to all those duties which tend to ripen the Christian for an exchange of worlds. But it would be doing injustice to her character in leaving one of her noblest deeds unrecorded, to close without mentioning the influence for good which she exerted over Mr. Adams, and her part in the work of making him what he was. That he was sensible of the benignant influence of wives, may be gathered from the following letter, which was addressed to Mrs. Adams from Philadelphia, on the 11th of August, 1777. I think I have sometimes observed to you in conversation, that upon examining the biography of illustrious men you will generally find some female about them, in the relation of mother or wife or sister, to whose instigation a great part of their merit is to be ascribed. You will find a curious example of this in the case of Aspasia, the wife of Pericles. She was a woman of the greatest beauty and the first genius. She taught him, it is said, his refined maxims of policy, his lofty imperial eloquence, nay, even composed the speeches on which so great a share of his reputation was founded. I wish some of our great men had such wives. By the account in your last letter, it seems the women in Boston begin to think themselves able to serve their country. What a pity it is that our generals in the northern districts had not Aspasias to their wives. I believe the two houses have not very great women to their wives. If they had, we should suffer more from their exertions than we do. This is our good fortune. A smart wife would have put Howe in possession of Philadelphia a long time ago. While Mr. Adams was wishing that some of our great men had such wives as Aspasia, he had such a wife, was himself such a man, and owed half his greatness to _Aspasia. The exalted patriotism and cheerful piety infused into the letters she addressed to him during the long night of political uncertainty that hung over the country, strengthened his courage, fired his nobler feelings, nerved his higher purposes, and, doubtless, greatly contributed to make him one of the chief pillars of the young republic. All honor to a brave wife, and not less heroic mother. If her husband and son kept the ship of state from the rocks, the light which guided them was largely from her. Heroic wife and mother, whose days were toil and grace, thy glory gleams for many another, and shines in many a face. The heart, as of a nation, throbs with thy tender love, and all our drama of salvation thou watchest from above. Our days, which yet are evil, and only free in part, have need of things with heaven coeval, of faith's unbounded heart. God grant the times approaching be full of glad events, no unheroic aims reproaching our line of presidents. V. Two neighbors. What they got out of life. It was just 2 o'clock of one of the warmest of the July afternoons. Mrs. Hill had her dinner all over, had put on her clean cap and apron, and was sitting on the north porch, making an unbleached cotton shirt for Mr. Peter Hill, who always wore unbleached shirts at harvest time. Mrs. Hill was a thrifty housewife. She had pursued this economical avocation for some little time, interrupting herself only at times to away the flocks of half-grown chickens that came noisily about the door for the crumbs from the tablecloth, when the sudden shutting down of a great blue cotton umbrella caused her to drop her work, and exclaim, "Well, now, Mrs. Troost, who would have thought you ever come to see me?" "Why, I have thought a great many times I would come," said the visitor, stamping her little feet, for she was a little woman, briskly on the blue flagstones, and then dusting them nicely with her white cambric handkerchief, before venturing on the snowy floor of Mrs. Hill. And, shaking hands, she added, "It has been a good while, for I remember when I was here last I had my Jane with me, quite a baby then, if you mind, and she is 3 years old now." "Is it possible?" said Mrs. Hill, untying the bonnet strings of her neighbor, who sighed as she continued, "Yes, she was 3 along in February, and she sighed again, more heavily than before, though there was no earthly reason that I know of why she should sigh, unless, perhaps, the flight of time, thus brought to mind, suggested the transitory nature of human things. Mrs. Hill laid the bonnet of Mrs. Troost on her spare bed, and covered it with a little pale blue crepe shawl, kept especially for such occasions, and, taking from the drawer of the bureau a large fan of turkey feathers, she presented it to her guest, saying, "A very warm day, isn't it?" "Oh, dreadful, dreadful. It seems as hot as a bake oven, and I suffer with the heat all summer, more or less. But it's a world of suffering," and Mrs. Troost half closed her eyes, as if to shut out the terrible reality. "Haymaking requires sunshiny weather, you know, so we must put up with it," said Mrs. Hill. "Besides, I can mostly find some cool place about the house. I keep my sewing here on the porch, and, as I bake my bread or cook my dinner, manage to catch it up sometimes, and so keep from getting overheated, and then, too, I get a good many stitches taken in the course of the day." "This __ nice cool place completely curtained with vines," said Mrs. Troost, and she sighed again. "They must have cost you a great deal of pains."
"Oh, no. No trouble at all. Morning glories grow themselves, they only require to be planted. I will save seed for you this fall, and next summer you can have your porch as shady as mine."
"And if I do, it would not signify," said Mrs. Troost. "I never get time to sit down from one week's end to another. Besides, I never had any luck with vines. Some folks don't, you know." Mrs. Hill was a woman of a short, plethoric habit, one that might be supposed to move about with little agility, and to find excessive warmth rather inconvenient, but she was of a happy, cheerful temperament, and when it rained she tucked up her skirts, put on thick shoes, and waddled about the same as ever, saying to herself, "This will make the grass grow," or, "It will bring on the radishes," or something else equally consolatory. Mrs. Troost, on the contrary, was a little thin woman, who looked as though she could move about nimbly at any season, but, as she herself often said, she was a poor, unfortunate creature, and pitied herself a great deal, as she was in justice bound to do, for nobody else cared, she said, how much she had to bear. They were near neighbors, these good women, but their social interchanges of tea drinking were not a very frequent occurrence, for sometimes Mrs. Troost had nothing to wear like other folks, sometimes it was too hot and sometimes it was too cold, and then, again, nobody wanted to see her, and she was sure she didn't want to go where she wasn't wanted. Moreover, she had such a great barn of a house as no other woman ever had to take care of. But in all the neighborhood it was called the Big House, so Mrs. Troost was in some measure compensated for the pains it cost her. It was, however, as she said, a barn of a place, with half the rooms unfurnished, partly because they had no use for them, and partly because they were unable to get furniture. So it stood right in the sun, with no shutters, and no trees about it, and Mrs. Troost said she didn't suppose it ever would have. She was always opposed to building it, but she never had her way about anything. Nevertheless, some people said Mr. Troost had taken the dimensions of his house with his wife's apron strings, but that may have been slander. While Mrs. Troost sat sighing over things in general, Mrs. Hill sewed on the last button, and, shaking the loose threads from the completed garment, held it up a moment to take a satisfactory view, as it were, and folded it away. "Well, did you ever?" said Mrs. Troost. "You have made half a shirt, and I have got nothing at all done. My hands sweat so I cannot use the needle, and it's no use to try. Lay down your work for a little while, and we will walk in the garden." So Mrs. Hill threw a towel over her head, and, taking a little tin basin in her hand, the two went to the garden. Mrs. Troost, under the shelter of a blue umbrella, which she said was so heavy that it was worse than nothing. Beans, radishes, raspberries, and currants, besides many other things, were there in profusion, and Mrs. Troost said everything flourished for Mrs. Hill, while her garden was all choked up with weeds. "And you have bees, too, don't they sting the children, and give you a great deal of trouble?" Along in May, I guess it was, Troost, Mrs. Troost always called her husband so, bought a hive, or, rather, he traded a calf for one, a nice, likely calf, too, it was, and they never did us a bit of good, and the unhappy woman sighed. "They __ say, said Mrs. Hill, sympathizingly, "that bees won't work for some folks. In case their king dies they are very likely to quarrel and not do well, but we have never had any ill luck with ours, and we last year sold $40 worth of honey, besides having all we wanted for our own use."
"Did yours die off, or what, Mrs. Troost?"
"Why," said the ill-natured visitor, "my oldest boy got stung one day, and being angry, upset the hive,
and I never found it out for 2 or 3 days, and, sending Truce to put it up in its place, there was not a bee to be found high or low. You don't tell. The obstinate little creatures. But they must be treated kindly, and I have heard of their going off for less things. The basin was by this time filled with currants, and they returned to the house. Mrs. Hill, seating herself on the sill of the kitchen door, began to prepare her fruit for tea, while Mrs. Truce drew her chair near, saying, "Did you ever hear about William McMicken's bees?" Mrs. Hill had never heard, and, expressing an anxiety to do so, was told the following story. His wife, you know, was she that was Sally May, and it's an old saying. To change the name and not the letter, you marry for worse and not for better. Sally was a dressy, extravagant girl. She had her bonnet done up twice a year always, and there was no end to her frocks and ribbons and fine things. Her mother indulged her in everything. She used to say Sally deserved all she got, that she was worth her weight in gold. She used to go everywhere, Sally did. There was no big meeting that she was not at, and no quilting that she didn't help to get up. All the girls went to her for the fashions, for she was a good deal in town at her Aunt Hannah's, and always brought out the new patterns. She used to have her sleeves a little bigger than anybody else, you remember, and then she wore great stiffeners in them la, me. There was no end to her extravagance. She had a changeable silk, yellow and blue, made with a surplice front, and when she wore that, the ground wasn't good enough for her to walk on, so some folks used to say, but I never thought Sally was a bit proud or lifted up, and if anybody was sick there was no better-hearted creature than she, and then, she was always good-natured as the day was long, and would sing all the time at her work. I remember, along before she was married, she used to sing one song a great deal, beginning, "I've got a sweetheart with bright black eyes." And they said she meant William McMicken by that, and that she might not get him after all, for a good many thought they would never make a match, their dispositions were so contrary. William was of a dreadful quiet turn, and a great homebody, and as for being rich, he had nothing to brag of, though he was high-larned and followed the river as dark sometimes. Mrs. Hill had by this time prepared her currants, and Mrs. Troost paused from her story while she filled the kettle and attached the towel to the end of the well sweep, where it waved as a signal for Peter to come to supper. "Now, just move your chair a little nearer the kitchen door, if you please," said Mrs. Hill, "and I can make up my biscuit and hear you, too." Meantime, coming to the door with some breadcrumbs in her hands, she began scattering them on the ground and calling, "Biddy, biddy, biddy chicky, chicky, chicky," hearing which, a whole flock of poultry was around her in a minute, and, stooping down, she secured one of the fattest, which, an hour afterward, was broiled for supper. "Dear me, how easily you get along," said Mrs. Troost. And it was some time before she could compose herself sufficiently to take up the thread of her story. At length, however, she began with, "Well, as I was saying, nobody thought William McMicken would marry Sally May. Poor man. They say he is not like himself anymore. He may get a dozen wives, but he'll never get another Sally. A good wife she made him, for all she was such a wild girl. The old man May was opposed to the marriage, and threatened to turn Sally, his own daughter, out of house and home, but she was headstrong, and would marry whom she pleased, and so she did, though she never got a stitch of new clothes, nor one thing to keep house with. No, not one single thing did her father give her when she went away but a hive of bees. He was right down ugly, and called her Mrs. McMicken whenever he spoke to her after she was married, but Sally didn't seem to mind it, and took just as good care of the bees as though they were worth $1,000. Every day in winter she used to feed them maple sugar, if she had it, and if she had not, a little muscovite in a saucer or some old broken dish. But it happened one day that a bee stung her on the hand, the right one, I think it was, and Sally said right away that it was a bad sign, and that very night she dreamed that she went out to feed her bees, and a piece of black crepe was tied on the hive. She felt that it was a token of death, and told her husband so, and she told me and Mrs. Hanks. No, I won't be sure she told Mrs. Hanks, but Mrs. Hanks got to hear it some way. Well, said Mrs. Hill, wiping the tears away with her apron, I really didn't know, till now, that poor Mrs. McMicken was dead. Oh, she is not dead, answered Mrs. Troost, but as well as she ever was, only she feels that she is not long for this world. The painful interest of her story, however, had kept her from work, so the afternoon passed without her having accomplished much. She never could work when she went visiting. Meantime Mrs. Hill had prepared a delightful supper, without seeming to give herself the least trouble. Peter came precisely at the right moment, and, as he drew a pail of water, removed the towel from the well sweep, easily and naturally, thus saving his wife the trouble. Troost would never have thought of it, said his wife, and she finished with an well, as though all her tribulations would be over before long. As she partook of the delicious honey, she was reminded of her own upset hive, and the crispered radishes brought thoughts of the weedy garden at home, so that, on the whole, her visit, she said, made her perfectly wretched, and she should have no heart for a week, nor did the little basket of extra nice fruit which Mrs. Hill presented her as she was about to take leave heighten her spirits in the least. Her great heavy umbrella, she said, was burden enough for her. But Peter will take you in the carriage, insisted Mrs. Hill. No, said Mrs. Troost, as though charity was offered her, it will be more trouble to get in and out than to walk, and so she trudged home, saying, some folks are born to be lucky. Fie. Horace Greeley. Born 1811, died 1872. The molder of public opinion, the brave journalist. Mr. Greeley lived through the most eventful era in our public history since the adoption of the Federal Constitution. For the 18 years between the formation of the Republican Party, in 1854, and his sudden death in 1872, the stupendous civil convulsions through which we have passed have merely translated into acts, and recorded in our annals, the fruits of his thinking and the strenuous vehemence of his moral convictions. Whether he was right or wrong, is a question on which opinions will differ, but no person conversant with our history will dispute the influence which this remarkable and singularly endowed man has exerted in shaping the great events of our time. Whatever may be the ultimate judgment of other classes of his countrymen respecting the real value of his services, the colored race, when it becomes sufficiently educated to appreciate his career, must always recognize him as the chief author of their emancipation from slavery and their equal citizenship. Mr. Lincoln, to whom their ignorance as yet gives the chief credit, was a chip tossed on the surface of a resistless wave. The molder of public opinion. It was Mr. Greeley, more than any other man, who let loose the winds that lifted the waters and drove forward their foaming, tumbling billows. Mr. Greeley had lent his hand to stir public feeling to its profoundest depths before Mr. Lincoln's election became possible. He contributed more than any other man to defeat the compromise and settlement for which Mr. Lincoln and his chief adviser, Mr. Seward, were anxious in the exciting, expectant winter of 1860-61, and to precipitate an avoidable bloody war. It was he, carrying a majority of the Republican Party with him, who kept insisting, in the early stages of the conflict, that the emancipation of the slaves was an indispensable element of success. Mr. Lincoln stood out and resisted, ridiculing an emancipation proclamation as a bull against the comet. Mr. Greeley roused the Republican Party by that remarkable leader signed by his name and addressed to Mr. Lincoln, head of the prayer of 20 millions, the effect of which the president tried to parry by a public letter to the editor of the _Tribune_, written with all the dexterous ingenuity and telling aptness of phrase of which Mr. Lincoln was so great a master. But Mr. Greeley victoriously carried the Republican Party, which he had done more than all other men to form, with him, and within 2 months after Mr. Lincoln's reply to the prayer of 20 millions, his reluctance was overborne, and he was constrained to issue his celebrated proclamation, which committed the government to emancipation, and staked the success of the war on that issue. This culminating achievement, the greatest of Mr. Greeley's life, is the most signal demonstration of his talents. It was no sudden, random stroke. It was the effect of an accumulated, ever-rising, widening, deepening stream of influence, which had been gathering volume and momentum for years, and whose piling waters at last burst through and bore down every barrier. Mr. Greeley had long been doing all in his power to swell the tide of popular feeling against slavery, and it was chiefly in consequence of the tremendous force he had given to the movement that that barbarous institution was at last swept away. It is the most extraordinary revolution ever accomplished by a single mind with no other instrument than a public journal. It may be said, indeed, that Mr. Greeley had many zealous coadjutors. But so had Luther able coadjutors in the Protestant Reformation, so had Cromwell in the Commonwealth, so had Washington in our Revolution, so had Cobden in the repeal of the Corn Laws. They are nevertheless regarded as the leading minds in the respective innovations which they championed, and by as just a title Mr. Greeley will hold the first place with posterity on the roll of emancipation. This is the light in which he will be remembered so long as the history of our time shall be read. It may be said, again, that Mr. Greeley's efforts in this direction were aided by the tendencies of his time. But so were Luther's, and Cromwell's, and Washington's, and everybody's who has left a great mark on his age, and accomplished things full of consequences to future generations. The first qualification for exerting this kind of fruitful influence is for the leader to be in complete sympathy with the developing tendencies of his own epoch. This is necessary to make him the embodiment of its spirit, the representative of its ideas, the quickener of its passions, the reviver of its courage in adverse turns of fortune, the central mind whom other advocates of the cause consult, whose action they watch in every new emergency, and whose guidance they follow because he has resolute, unflagging confidence to lead. In the controversies in which Mr. Greeley has been behind his age, or stood against the march of progress, even he has accomplished little. Since Henry Clay's death, he has been the most noted and active champion of protection, but that cause steadily declined until the war forced the government to strain every source of revenue, and since the close of the war, free trade ideas have made surprising advances in Mr. Greeley's own political party. On this subject he was the disciple of dead masters, and hung to the skirts of a receding cause, but in this school he acquired the dexterity in handling the weapons of controversy which proved so effective when he advanced from the position of a disciple to that of a master, and led a movement in the direction towards which the rising popular feeling was tending. Mr. Greeley's name will always be identified with the extirpation of Negro slavery as its most distinguished, powerful, and effective advocate. The brave journalist. This is his valid title to distinction and lasting fame. Instrumental to this, and the chief means of its attainment, he founded a public journal which grew, under his direction, to be a great moving force in the politics and public thought of our time. This alone would have attested his energy and abilities, but this is secondary praise. It is the use he made of his journal when he had created it, the moral ends to which, besides making it a vehicle of news and the discussion of ephemeral topics, he devoted it, that will give him his peculiar place in history. If he had had no higher aim than to supply the market for current intelligence, as a great merchant supplies the market for dry goods, he would have deserved to rank with the builders up of other prosperous establishments by which passing contemporary ones were supplied, but would have had no claim on the remembrance of coming generations. But he regarded his journal not primarily as a property, but as the instrument of high moral and political ends, an instrument whose great potency for good or ill he fully comprehended, and for whose salutary direction he felt a corresponding responsibility. His simple tastes, inexpensive habits, his contempt for the social show and parade which are the chief use made of wealth, and the absorption of his mind in other aims, made it impossible for him to think of the _Tribune_ merely as a source of income, and he always managed it mainly with a view to make it an efficient organ for diffusing opinions which he thought conducive to the public welfare. It was this which distinguished Mr. Greeley from the founders of other important journals, who have, in recent years, been taken from us. With him the moral aim was always paramount, the pecuniary aim subordinate. Journalism, as he looked upon it, was not an end, but a means to higher ends. He may have had many mistaken and some erratic opinions on particular subjects, but the moral earnestness with which he pursued his vocation, and his constant subordination of private interest to public objects, nobly atoned for his occasional errors. Among the means by which Mr. Greeley gained, and so long held, the first place among American journalists, was his manner of writing. His negative merits as a writer were great, and it would be surprising to find these negative merits so rare as to be a title to distinction, if observation did not force the faults he avoided so perpetually upon our notice. He had no verbiage. We do not merely mean by this that he never used a superfluous word, which, in fact, he rarely did, but that he kept quite clear of the hazy, half-relevant ideas which encumber meaning and are the chief source of prolixity. He threw away every idea that did not decidedly help on his argument, and express the others in the fewest words that would make them clear. He began at once where the pith of his argument began, and had the secret, possessed by few writers, of stopping the moment he was done, leaving his readers no chaff to sift out from the simple wheat. This perfect absence of cloudy irrelevance and encumbering superfluity was one source of his popularity as a writer. His readers had to devour no husks to get at the kernel of what he meant. Besides these negative recommendations, Mr. Greeley's style had positive merits of a very high order. The source of these was in the native structure of his mind, no training could have conferred them, and it was his original mental qualities, and not any special culture, that pruned his writing of verbiage and redundancies. Whatever he saw with wonderful distinctness. Whether it happened to be a sound idea or a crotchet, it stood before his mind with the clearness of an object in sunlight. He never groped at and around it, like one feeling in the dark. He saw on which side he could lay hands on it at once with the firmest grasp. It was his vividness of conception which made Mr. Greeley so clear and succinct a writer. He knew precisely what he would be at, and he hastened to say it in the fewest words. His choice of language, though often homely, and sometimes quaint or coarse, was always adapted to his purpose. He had a great command of racy phrases in common use, and frequently gave them an unexpected turn which enlivened his style as by a sudden stroke of wit or grotesque humor. But these touches were rapid, never detained him, he kept grappling with his argument, and hurried on. This peculiar style was aided by the ardor of his feelings and his vehement moral earnestness. Bent on convincing, he tried to flash his meaning on the minds of his readers in the readiest and manliest way, and he was so impatient to make them see the full force of his main points that he stripped them as naked as he could. This combined clearness of perception, strength of conviction, and hurrying ardor of feeling, were the sources of a style which enabled him to write more than any other journalist of his time, and yet always command attention. But he is a model which none can successfully imitate without his strongly marked individuality and peculiarities of mental structure. We have mentioned his occasional coarseness, but it was merely his preference of strong direct expression to dainty feebleness. He was never vulgar. Mr. Greeley has contributed to the surprising growth and development of journalism in our time, chiefly by his successful efforts to make it a guide of public opinion, as well as a chronicle of important news. In his hands, it was not merely a mirror which indifferently reflects back the images of all objects on which it is turned, but a creative force, a means of calling into existence a public opinion powerful enough to introduce great reforms and sweep down abuses. He had no faith in purposeless journalism, in journalism which has so little insight into the tendencies of the time that it shifts its view from day to day in accommodation to transient popular caprices. No great object is accomplished without constancy of purpose, and a guide of public opinion cannot be constant unless he has a deep and abiding conviction of the importance of what he advocates. Mr. Greeley's remarkable power, when traced back to its main source, will be found to have consisted chiefly in that vigorous earnestness of belief which held him to the strenuous advocacy of measures which he thought conducive to the public welfare, whether they were temporarily popular or not. Journalism may perhaps gain more success as a mercantile speculation by other methods, but it can be respected as a great moral and political force only in the hands of men who have the talents, foresight, and moral earnestness which fit them to guide public opinion. It is in this sense that Mr. Greeley was our first journalist, and nobody can successfully dispute his rank, any more than Mr. Bennett's could be contested in the kind that seeks to float on the current instead of directing its course. The one did most to render our American journals great vehicles of news, the other to make them controlling organs of opinion. Their survivors in the profession have much to learn from both. _New York World_ Knight of the ready pen, soldier without a sword, such eyes hadst thou for other men, so true and grand a word. As Caesar led his legions triumphant over Gaul, and through still wilder, darker regions, so thou didst lead us all. Until we saw the chains which bound our brothers' lives, and heard the groans and felt the pains, which come from wearing gyves. To brave heroic men the false no more was true, and what the nation needed then could any soldier do. 7. Wendell Phillips. Born 1811, died 1884. The times when he appeared, who is this fellow? A flaming advocate of liberty, liberty of speech and thought, power to discern the right, the mob-beaten hero triumphant. Long chapters of history are illumined as by as electric light in the following characteristic address from his pulpit by Henry Ward Beecher, at the time the name of the great philanthropist was added to the roll of American heroes. The times when he appeared. The condition of the public mind throughout the North at the time I came to the consciousness of public affairs and was studying my profession may be described, in one word, as the condition of imprisoned moral sense. All men, almost, agreed with all men that slavery was wrong, but what can we do? The compromises of our fathers include us and bind us to fidelity to the agreements that had been made in the formation of our Constitution. Our Confederation first, and our Constitution after. These were regarded everywhere as moral obligations by men that hated slavery. The compromises of the Constitution must be respected, said the priest in the pulpit, said the politician in the field, said the statesman in public halls, and men abroad, in England especially, could not understand what was the reason of the hesitancy of President Lincoln and of the people, when they had risen to arms, in declaring at once the end for which arms were taken and armies gathered to be the emancipation of the slaves. There never has been an instance in which, I think, the feelings and the moral sense of so large a number of people have been held in check for reasons of fidelity to obligations assumed in their behalf. There never has been in history another instance more notable, and I am bound to say, with all its faults and weaknesses, more noble. The commercial question, that being the underlying moral element, the commercial question of the North very soon became, on the subject of slavery, what the industrial and political question of the South had made it. It corrupted the manufacturer and the merchant. Throughout the whole North, every man that could make anything regarded the South as his legal, lawful market, for the South did not manufacture, it had the cheap and vulgar husbandry of slavery. They could make more money with cotton than with corn, or beef, or pork, or leather, or hats, or woodenware, and northern ships went south to take their forest timbers, and brought them to Connecticut to be made into woodenware and axe helves and rake handles, and carried them right back to sell to the men whose axes had cut down the trees. The South manufactured nothing except slaves. It was a great manufacture, that, and the whole market of the North was bribed. The harness makers, the wagon makers, the clock makers, makers of all manner of implements, of all manner of goods, every manufactory, every loom as it clanked in the North said, maintain, not slavery, but the compromises of the Constitution. The Constitution that was the veil under which all these cries were continually uttered. The distinction between the anti-slavery men and abolitionists was simply this: the abolitionists disclaimed the obligation to maintain this government and the compromises of the Constitution, and the anti-slavery men recognized the binding obligation and sought the emancipation of slaves by the more circuitous and gradual influence, but abolitionism covered both terms. It was regarded, however, throughout the North as a greater sin than slavery itself, and none of you that are under 30 years of age can form any adequate conception of the public sentiment and feeling during the days of my young manhood. A man that was known to be an abolitionist had better be known to have the plague. Every door was shut to him. If he was born under circumstances that admitted him to the best society, he was the black sheep of the family. If he aspired by fidelity, industry, and genius, to good society, he was debarred. An abolitionist was enough to put the mark of Cain upon any young man that arose in my early day, and until I was 40 years of age. It was punishable to preach on the subject of liberty. It was enough to expel a man from church communion, if he insisted on praying in the prayer meeting for the liberation of the slaves. The church was dumb in the North, not in the West. The great publishing societies that were sustained by the contributions of the churches were absolutely dumb. Who is this fellow? It was at the beginning of this Egyptian era in America that the young aristocrat of Boston appeared. His blood came through the best colonial families. He was an aristocrat by descent and by nature, a noble one, but a thorough aristocrat. All his life and power assumed that guise. He was noble, he was full of kindness to inferiors, he was willing to be, and do, and suffer for them, but he was never of them, nor equaled himself to them. He was always above them, and his gifts of love were always the gifts of a prince to his subjects. All his life long he resented every attack on his person and on his honor, as a noble aristocrat would. When they poured the filth of their imaginations upon him, he cared no more for it than the eagle cares what the fly is thinking about him away down under the cloud. All the miserable traffickers, and all the scribblers, and all the aristocratic boobies of Boston were no more to him than mosquitoes are to the behemoth or to the lion. He was aristocratic in his pride, and lived higher than most men lived. He was called of God as much as ever Moses and the prophets were, not exactly for the same great end, but in consonance with those great ends. You remember, my brother, when Lovejoy was infamously slaughtered by a mob in Alton. Blood that has been the seed of liberty all over this land. I remember it. At this time it was that Channing lifted up his voice and declared that the moral sentiment of Boston ought to be uttered in rebuke of that infamy and cruelty, and asking for Faneuil Hall in which to call a public meeting. This was indignantly refused by the Common Council of Boston. Being a man of wide influence, he gathered around about himself enough venerable and influential old citizens of Boston to make a denial of their united request a perilous thing, and Faneuil Hall was granted to call a public meeting to express itself on this subject of the murder of Lovejoy. The meeting was made up largely of rowdies. They meant to overawe and put down all other expressions of opinion except those that then rioted with the riotous. United States District Attorney Austin, when Wendell Phillips's name is written in letters of light on one side of the monument, down low on the other side, and spattered with dirt, let the name of Austin also be written, made a truculent speech, and justified the mob, and ran the whole career of the sewer of those days and justified non-interference with slavery. Wendell Phillips, just come to town as a young lawyer, without it present any practice, practically unknown, except to his own family, fired with the infamy, and, feeling called of God in his soul, went upon the platform. His first utterances brought down the hisses of the mob. He was not a man very easily subdued by any mob. They listened as he kindled and poured on that man Austin the fire and lava of a volcano, and he finally turned the course of the feeling of the meeting. Practically unknown when the sun went down one day, when it rose next morning all Boston was saying, "Who is this fellow? Who is this Phillips?" A question that has never been asked since. A flaming advocate of liberty. Thenceforth he has been a flaming advocate of liberty, with singular advantages over all other pleaders. Mr. Garrison was not noted as a speaker, yet his tongue was his pen. Mr. Phillips, not much given to the pen, his pen was his tongue, and no other like speaker has ever graced our history. I do not undertake to say that he surpassed all others. He had an intense individuality, and that intense individuality ranked him among the noblest orators that have ever been born to this continent, or I may say to our motherland. He adopted in full the tenets of Garrison, which were excessively disagreeable to the whole public mind. The ground which he took was that which Garrison took. Seeing that the conscience of the North was smothered and mute by reason of the supposed obligations to the compromises of the Constitution, Garrison declared that the compromises of the Constitution were covenants with hell, and that no man was bound to observe them. This extreme ground Mr. Phillips also took: immediate, unconditional, universal emancipation, at any cost whatsoever. That is Garrisonism, that is Wendell Phillipsism, and it would seem as though the Lord rather leaned that way, too. I shall not discuss the merits of Mr. Garrison or Mr. Phillips in every direction. I shall say that while the duty of immediate emancipation without conditions was unquestionably the right ground, yet in the providence of God even that could not be brought to pass except through the mediation of very many events. It is a remarkable thing that Mr. Phillips and Mr. Garrison both renounced the Union and denounced the Union in the hope of destroying slavery, whereas the providence of God brought about the love of the Union when it was assailed by the South, and made the love of the Union the enthusiasm that carried the great war of emancipation through. It was the very antithesis of the ground which they took. Like John Brown, Mr. Garrison, like John Brown, Mr. Phillips, of a heroic spirit, seeking the great and noble, but by measures not well adapted to secure the end. Little by little the controversy spread. I shall not trace it. I am giving you simply the atmosphere in which he sprang into being and into power. His career was a career of 30 or 40 years of undiminished eagerness. He never quailed nor flinched, nor did he ever at any time go back one step or turn in the slightest degree to the right or left. He gloried in his cause, and in that particular aspect of it which had selected him, for he was one that was called rather than one that chose. He stood on this platform. It is a part of the sweet and pleasant memories of my comparative youth here, that when the mob refused to let him speak in the Broadway Tabernacle before it moved uptown the old Tabernacle, William A. Hall, now dead, a fervent friend and abolitionist, had secured the Graham Institute wherein to hold a meeting where Mr. Phillips should be heard. I had agreed to pray at the opening of the meeting. On the morning of the day on which it was to have taken place, I was visited by the committee of that Institute, excellent gentlemen, whose feelings will not be hurt now, because they are all now ashamed of it, they are in heaven. They visited me to say that in consequence of the great peril that attended a meeting at the Institute, they had withdrawn the liberty to use it, and paid back the money, and that they called simply to say that it was out of no disrespect to me, but from fidelity to their supposed trust. Well, it was a bitter thing. Liberty of speech and thought. If there is anything on earth that I am sensitive to, it is the withdrawing of the liberty of speech and thought. Henry C. Bowen, who certainly has done some good things in his lifetime, said to me, "You can have Plymouth Church if you want it." How? It is the rule of the church trustees that the church may be let by a majority vote when we are convened, but if we are not convened, then every trustee must give his assent in writing. If you choose to make it a personal matter, and go to every trustee, you can have it. He meanwhile undertook, with Mr. Hall, to put new placards over the old ones, notifying men quietly that the meeting was to be held here, and distributed thousands and tens of thousands of handbills at the ferries. No task was ever more welcome. I went to the trustees man by man. The majority of the trustees very cheerfully accorded the permission. One or two of them were disposed to decline and withhold it. I made it a matter of personal friendship. "You and I will break, if you don't give me this permission." And they signed. So the meeting glided from the Graham Institute to this house. A great audience assembled. We had detectives in disguise, and every arrangement made to handle the subject in a practical form if the crowd should undertake to molest us. The Reverend Dr. R.S. Storrs consented to come and pray, for Mr. Wendell Phillips was by marriage a near and intimate friend and relation of his. The reporters were here, when were they ever not? Mr. Phillips began his lecture, and, you may depend upon it, by this time the lion was in him, and he went careering on. High views were extreme, he made them extravagant. I remember at one point, for he was a man without bluster, serene, self-poised, never disturbed in the least, he made an affirmation that was very bitter, and the cry arose over the whole congregation. He stood still, with a cold, bitter smile in his eye, and waited till they subsided, when he repeated it with more emphasis. Again the roar went through. He waited and repeated it, if possible, more intensely, and he beat them down with that one sentence until they were still, and let him go on. Power to discern the right. The power to discern right amid all the wrappings of interest and all the seductions of ambition was singularly his. To choose the lowly for their sake, to abandon all favor, all power, all comfort, all ambition, all greatness that was his genius and glory. He confronted the spirit of the nation and of the age. I had almost said he set himself against nature, as if he had been a decree of God overriding all these other insuperable obstacles. That was his function. Mr. Phillips was not called to be a universal order any more than he was a universal thinker. In literature and in history widely read, in person magnificent, in manners most accomplished, gentle as a babe, sweet as a new-blown rose, in voice clear and silvery, yet he was not a man of tempests, he was not an orchestra of 100 instruments, he was not an organ, mighty and complex. The nation slept, and God wanted a trumpet, sharp, wide-sounding, narrow and intense, and that was Mr. Phillips. The long roll is not particularly agreeable in music, or in times of war, but it is better than flutes or harps when men are in a great battle, or are on the point of it. His eloquence was penetrating and alarming. He did not flow as a mighty Gulf Stream, he did not dash upon this continent as the ocean does, he was not a mighty rushing river. His eloquence was a flight of arrows, sentence after sentence polished, and most of them burning. He slung them one after the other, and where they struck they slew. Always elegant, always awful. I think his scornism was as fine as I ever knew it in any human being. He had that sublime sanctuary in his pride that made him almost insensitive to what would by other men be considered obloquy. It was as if he said every day in himself, I am not what they are firing at. I am not there, and I am not that. It is not against me. I am infinitely superior to what they think me to be. They do not know me. It was quiet and unpretentious, but it was there. Conscience and pride were the two concurrent elements of his nature. The mob-beaten hero triumphant. He lived to see the slave emancipated, but not by mortal means. He lived to see the sword cut the fetter. After this had taken place, he was too young to retire, though too old to gather laurels of literature or to seek professional honors. The impulse of humanity was not at all abated. His soul still flowed on for the great undermasses of mankind, though, like the Nile, it split up into scores of mouths, and not all of them were navigable. After a long and stormy life his son went down in glory. All the English-speaking people on the globe have written among the names that shall never die the name of that scoffed, detested, mob-beaten, persecuted wretch Wendell Phillips. Boston, that persecuted and would have slain him, is now exceedingly busy in building his tomb and rearing his statue. The men that would not defile their lips with his name are thanking God today that he lived. He has taught some lessons that the young will do well to take heed to, that the most splendid gifts and opportunities and ambitions may be best used for the dumb and lowly. His whole life is a rebuke to the idea that we are to climb to greatness by climbing up on the backs of great men, that we are to gain strength by running with the currents of life, that we can from without add anything to the great within that constitutes man. He poured out the precious ointment of his soul upon the feet of the diffuse of Jesus who suffers here in his poor and despised ones. He has taught young ambitions, too, that the way to glory is the way oftentimes of adhesion simply to principle, and that popularity and unpopularity are not things to be known or considered. Do right and rejoice. If to do right will bring you under trouble, rejoice in it that you are counted worthy to suffer with God and the providences of God in this world. He belongs to the race of giants, not simply because he was, in and of himself a great soul, but because he had bathed in the providence of God and came forth scarcely less than a god, because he gave himself to the work of God upon earth, and inherited thereby, or had reflected upon him, some of the majesty of his master. When pygmies are all dead, the noble countenance of Wendell Phillips will still look forth, radiant as a rising sun, a sun that will never set. He has become to us a lesson, his death an example, his whole history an encouragement to manhood and to heroic manhood. 8. Mary Wordsworth. Born 1770, died 1859. The kindly wife of the great poet. A creature not too bright or good for human nature's daily food. The last thing that would have occurred to Mrs. Wordsworth would have been that her departure, or anything about her, would be publicly noticed amidst the events of a stirring time. Those who knew her well regarded her with as true a homage as they ever rendered to any member of the household, or to any personage of the remarkable group which will be forever traditionally associated with the Lake District. But this reverence, genuine and hearty as it was, would not, in all eyes, be a sufficient reason for recording more than the fact of her death. It is her survivorship of such a group which constitutes an undisputed public interest in her decease. With her closes a remarkable scene in the history of the literature of our century. The well-known cottage, mound, and garden at Rydal will be regarded with other eyes when shut up or transferred to new occupants. With Mrs. Wordsworth, an old world has passed away before the eyes of the inhabitants of the district, and a new one succeeds, which may have its own delights, solemnities, honors, and graces, but which can never replace the familiar one that is gone. There was something mournful in the lingering of this aged lady, blind, deaf, and bereaved in her latter years, but she was not mournful, any more than she was insensible. Age did not blunt her feelings, nor deaden her interest in the events of the day. It seems not so very long ago that she said that the worst of living in such a place, as the Lake District, was its making one unwilling to go. It is too beautiful to let one be ready to leave it. Within a few years the beloved daughter was gone, and then the aged husband, and then the son-in-law, and then a devoted friend, Mr. Wordsworth's publisher, Mr. Moxon, who paid his duty occasionally by the side of her chair, then she became blind and deaf. Still her cheerfulness was indomitable. No doubt, she would in reality have been willing to go, whenever called upon, throughout her long life, but she liked life to the end. By her disinterestedness of nature, by her fortitude of spirit, and her constitutional elasticity and activity, she was qualified for the honor of surviving her household, nursing and burying them, and bearing the bereavement which they were vicariously spared. She did it wisely, tenderly, bravely, and cheerfully, and then she will be remembered accordingly by all who witnessed the spectacle. It was by the accident, so to speak, of her early friendship with Wordsworth's sister, that her life became involved with the poetic element which her mind would hardly have sought for itself in another position. She was the incarnation of good sense, as applied to the concerns of the everyday world. In as far as her marriage and course of life tended to infuse a new elevation into her views of things, it was a blessing, and, on the other hand, in as far as it infected her with the spirit of exclusiveness, which was the grand defect of the group in its own place, it was hurtful. But that very exclusiveness was less an evil than an amusement, after all. It was rather a serious matter to hear the poet's denunciation of the railway, and to read his well-known sonnets on the desecration of the lake region by the unhallowed presence of commonplace strangers, and it was truly painful to observe how the scornful and grudging mood spread among the young, who thought they were agreeing with Wordsworth in claiming the vales and lakes as a natural property for their enlightened selves. But it was so unlike Mrs. Wordsworth, with her kindly, cheery, generous turn, to say that a green field, with buttercups, would answer all the purposes of Lancashire operatives, and that they did not know what to do with themselves when they came among the mountains, that the innocent insolence could do no harm. It became a fixed sentiment when she alone survived to uphold it, and one demonstration of it amused the whole neighborhood in a good-natured way. People from Berthwaite were the bugbear, Berthwaite being the end of the railway. In the summer of 1857, Mrs. Wordsworth's companion told her, she being then blind, that there were some strangers in the garden, two or three boys on the mound, looking at the view. "Boys from Berthwaite," said the old lady, in the well-known tone, which conveyed that nothing good could come from Berthwaite. When the strangers were gone, it appeared that they were the Prince of Wales and his companions. Making allowance for prejudices, neither few nor small, but easily dissolved when reason and kindliness had opportunity to work, she was a truly wise woman, equal to all occasions of action, and supplying other persons' needs and deficiencies. In the memoirs of Wordsworth it is stated that she was the original of. She was a phantom of delight. And some things in the next few pages look like it, but for the greater part of the poet's life it was certainly believed by some, who ought to know, that that wonderful description related to another who flitted before his imagination in earlier days than those in which he discovered the aptitude of Mary Hutchinson to his own needs. The last stanza is very like her, and her husband's sonnet to the painter of her portrait, in old age, discloses to us how the first stanza might be also, in days beyond the ken of the existing generation. Of her early sorrows, in the loss of two children and a beloved sister, who was domesticated with the family, there are probably no living witnesses. It will never be forgotten, by those who saw it, how the late dreary train of afflictions was met. For many years Wordsworth's sister Dorothy was a melancholy charge. Mrs. Wordsworth was wont to warn any rash enthusiasts for mountain walking by the spectacle before them. The adoring sister would never fail her brother, and she destroyed her health, and then her reason, by exhausting walks and wrong remedies for the consequences. 40 miles in a day was not a singular feat of Dorothy's. During the long years of this devoted creature's helplessness she was tended with admirable cheerfulness and good sense. Thousands of lake tourists must remember the locked garden gate when Miss Wordsworth was taking the air, and the garden chair going round and round the terrace, with the emaciated little woman in it, who occasionally called out to strangers and amused them with her clever sayings. She outlived the beloved Dora, Wordsworth's only surviving daughter. After the lingering illness of that daughter, Mrs. Quillenan, the mother, encountered the dreariest portion, probably, of her life. Her aged husband used to spend the long winter evenings in grief and tears week after week, month after month. Neither of them had eyes for reading. He could not be comforted. She, who carried as tender a maternal heart as ever beat, had to bear her own grief and his too. She grew whiter and smaller, so as to be greatly changed in a few months, but this was the only expression of what she endured, and he did not discover it. When he, too, left her, it was seen how disinterested had been her trouble. When his trouble had ceased, she, too, was relieved. She followed his coffin to the sacred corner of Grasmere churchyard, where lay now all those who had once made her home. She joined the household guests on their return from the funeral, and made tea as usual. And this was the disinterested spirit which carried her through the last few years, till she had just reached the 90th. Even then she had strength to combat disease for many days. Several times she rallied and relapsed, and she was full of alacrity of mind and body as long as exertion of any kind was possible. There were many eager to render all duty and love her two sons, nieces, and friends, and a whole sympathizing neighborhood. The question commonly asked by visitors to that corner of Grasmere churchyard was, where would __she__ be laid when the time came? The space was so completely filled. The cluster of stones told of the little children who died a long lifetime ago, of the sisters Sarah Hutchinson and Dorothy Wordsworth, and of Mr. Quillenan, and his two wives, Dora lying between her husband and father, and seeming to occupy her mother's rightful place. And Hartley Coleridge lies next the family group, and others press closely round. There is room, however. The large grey stone, which bears the name of William Wordsworth, has ample space left for another inscription, and the grave beneath has ample space also for his faithful life companion. Not one is left now of the eminent persons who rendered that cluster of valleys so eminent as it has been. Dr. Arnold went first, in the vigor of his years. Southey died at Keswick, and Hartley Coleridge on the margin of Rydal Lake, and the Quillenans under the shadow of Lough Rig, and Professor Wilson disappeared from Ellery, and the aged Mrs. Fletcher from Lank Rig, and the three venerable Wordsworths from Rydal Mound. The survivor of all the rest had a heart and a memory for the solemn __last__ of everything. She was the one to inquire of about the last eagle in the district, the last pair of ravens in any crest of rocks, the last old dalesman in any improved spot, the last round of the last peddler among hills where the broad white road has succeeded the green bridal path. She knew the district during the period between its first recognition, through Gray's letters, to its complete publicity in the age of railways. She saw, perhaps, the best of it. But she contributed to modernize and improve it, though the idea of doing so probably never occurred to her. There were great people before to give away Christmas bounties, and spoil their neighbors, as the established almsgiving of the rich does spoil the laboring class, which ought to be above that kind of aid. Mrs. Wordsworth did infinitely more good in her own way, and without being aware of it. An example of comfortable thrift was a greater boon to the people round than money, clothes, meat, or fuel. The oldest residents have long borne witness that the homes of the neighbors have assumed a new character of order and comfort, and wholesome economy, since the poet's family lived at Rydal Mound. It used to be a pleasant sight when Wordsworth was seen in the middle of a hedge, cutting switches for half a dozen children, who were pulling at his cloak, or gathering about his heels, and it will long be pleasant to family friends to hear how the young wives of half a century learned to make home comfortable by the example of the good housewife at the Mound, who never was above letting her thrift be known. Finally, she who had noted so many last survivors was herself the last of a company more venerable than eagles, or ravens, or old-world yeomen, or antique customs. She would not, in any case, be the first forgotten. As it is, her honored name will live for generations in the traditions of the valleys round. If she was studied as the poet's wife, she came out so well from that investigation that she was contemplated for herself, and the image so received is her true monument. It will be better preserved in her old-fashioned neighborhood than many monuments which make a greater show. She was a phantom of delight when first she gleamed upon my sight, a lovely apparition, sent to he a moment's ornament, her eyes, as stars of twilight fair, like twilights, too, her dusky hair, but all things else about her drawn from May time and the cheerful dawn, a dancing shape, an image gay, to haunt, to startle, and waylay. And now I see, with eye serene, the very pulse of the machine, a being breathing thoughtful breath, a traveler between life and death, the reason firm, the temperate will, endurance, foresight, strength, and skill, a perfect woman, nobly planned, to warn, to comfort, and command, and yet a spirit still and bright, with something of an angel light. Harriet Martineau, in 1859-9. Madame Malibran. Born 1808, died 1836. Her career as a singer, kindness of heart. Marie Felicita Garcia, who died at the early age of 28, was one of the greatest singers the world has ever known. Born at Paris in 1808, according to some biographers at Turin, she was the daughter of Manuel Garcia, the famous Spanish tenor singer, by whom she was so thoroughly trained that she made her first public appearance in London March 25, 1826, and achieved a remarkable and instant success. She sang with wonderful acceptance in different parts of England, and in the autumn of the same year came to America as prima donna of an opera company under the management of her father. In New York her success was without precedent. In the memory of many aged people there she still holds her place as the Queen of Song. In the following year she married Eugene Malibran, an elderly French merchant, under whose name she was ever afterwards known. Returning to Europe, she made her first appearance in Paris January 14, 1828, where she added other jewels to the singer's crown. We cannot follow her throughout her brilliant career, but must hasten on to the closing scenes of her life. In May 1836, she fell from her horse and was seriously injured. Not considering the matter in its true aspect, she kept her engagements during the summer, and in September appeared in England, at the Manchester Musical Festival, though warned by her physician to desist. As the result of the imprudence a nervous fever set in, and she died September 23d, 1836. In one of the many notices of this great singer, these words are found. Madame Malibran's voice was a mezzo-soprano of great volume and purity, and had been brought to absolute perfection by the severe training of her father. Her private character was irreproachable. Few women have been more beloved for their amiability, generosity, and professional enthusiasm. Her intellect was of a high order, and the charms of her conversation fascinated all who were admitted into the circle of her intimate friends. Her benefactions amounted to such considerable sums that her friends were frequently obliged to interfere for the purpose of regulating her finances. Many stories are told, which show her kindness of heart. The following is one of pathetic interest. In a humble room in one of the poorest streets of London, Pierre, a faithful French boy, sat humming by the bedside of his sick mother. There was no bread in the closet, and for the whole day he had not tasted food. Yet he sat humming to keep up his spirits. Still at times he thought of his loneliness and hunger, and he could scarcely keep the tears from his eyes, for he knew that nothing would be so grateful to his poor invalid mother as a good, sweet orange, and yet he had not a penny in the world. The little song he was singing was his own one he had composed, both air and words, for the child was a genius. He went to the window, and, looking out, saw a man putting up a great bill with yellow letters, announcing that Madame Malibran would sing that night in public. "Oh, if I could only go," thought little Pierre, and then pausing a moment, he clasped his hands.